Because of the length of the voyage and the planned amphibious invasions, each warship in Anson's squadron was supposed to carry an even greater number of seamen and marines than it was designed for. The Centurion, which typically held 400 people, was expected to sail with some 500, and the Wager would be packed with about 250, nearly double its usual complement. Cheap had waited and waited for crewmen to arrive, but the Navy had exhausted its supply of volunteers, and Great Britain had no military conscription. Robert Walpole, the country's first prime minister, warned that the dearth of crews had rendered a third of the Navy ships unusable. "Oh, seamen, seamen, seamen," he cried at a meeting. While Cheap was struggling with other officers to scrounge up sailors for the squadron, he received more unsettling news. Those men who had been recruited were falling sick. Their heads throbbed and their limbs were so sore they felt as if they'd been pummeled. In severe cases, these symptoms were compounded by diarrhea, vomiting, bursting blood vessels, and fevers reaching as high as 106 degrees, which led to delirium, catching at imaginary objects in the air, as a medical treatise put it. Some men succumbed even before they had gone to sea. Cheap counted at least 200 sick and more than 25 dead on the Centurion alone. He had brought his young nephew Henry to apprentice on the expedition, and what if he perished? Even Cheap, who was so indomitable, was suffering from what he called a very indifferent state of health. It was a devastating epidemic of ship's fever, now known as typhus. No one then understood that the disease was a bacterial infection transmitted by lice and other vermin. As boats transported unwashed recruits cramped together in filth, the men became lethal vectors, more deadly than a cascade of cannonballs. Anson instructed Cheap to have the sick rushed to a makeshift hospital in Gosport near Portsmouth in the hope that they would recover in time for the voyage. The squadron still desperately needed men, but as the hospital became overcrowded, most of the sick had to be lodged in surrounding taverns, which offered more liquor than medicine, and where three patients sometimes had to squeeze into a single cot. As Admiral noted, in this miserable way they die very fast. After peaceful efforts to man the fleets failed, the Navy resorted to what a Secretary of the Admiralty called a more violent strategy. Armed gangs were dispatched to press seafaring men into service, in effect kidnapping them. The gangs roamed cities and towns, grabbing anyone who betrayed the telltale signs of a mariner. The familiar checkered shirt and wide kneed trousers and round hat, the fingers smeared with tar, which was used to make virtually everything on a ship more water-resistant and durable. Seamen were known as tars. Local authorities were ordered to seize all straggling seamen, watermen, bargemen, fishermen, and lightermen. A seaman later described walking into London and having a stranger tap him on the shoulder and demand, "What ship?" The seaman denied that he was a sailor, but his tar-stained fingertips betrayed him. The stranger blew his whistle, and in an instant a posse appeared. "I was in the hands of 6 or 8 ruffians, whom I soon found to be a press gang," the seaman wrote. "They dragged me hurriedly through several streets amid bitter execrations bestowed on them from passers-by and expressions of sympathy directed towards me." Press gangs had headed out in boats as well, scouring the horizon for incoming merchant ships, the most fertile hunting ground. Often, men seized were returning from distant voyages and hadn't seen their families for years. Given the risks of a subsequent long voyage during war, they might never see them again. Cheap became so close to a young shipman on the Centurion named John Campbell, who had been pressed while serving on a merchant ship. A gang had invaded his vessel, and when he saw them hauling away an older man in tears, he stepped forward and offered himself up in his place. The head of the press gang remarked, "I would rather have a lad of spirit than a blubbering man." Anson was said to have been so struck by Campbell's gallantry that he'd made him a midshipman. Most sailors, though, went to extraordinary lengths to evade the body snatchers, hiding in cramped holds, listing themselves as dead in muster books, and abandoning merchant ships before reaching a major port. When a press gang surrounded a church in London in 1755, in pursuit of a seaman inside, he managed, according to a newspaper report, to slip away disguised in an old gentlewoman's long cloak, hood, and bonnet. Sailors who got snatched up were transported into the holds of small ships known as tenders, which resembled floating jails, with gratings bolted over the hatchways and marines standing guard with muskets and bayonets. In this place we spent the day and following night huddled together, for there was not room to sit or stand separate, one seaman recalled. Indeed, we were in a pitiable plight, for numbers of them were seasick, some retching, others were smoking, while many were so overcome by the stench that they fainted for want of air. Family members, upon learning that a relative, a son or a brother or a husband or a father had been apprehended, would often rush to where the tenders were departing, hoping to catch a glimpse of their loved ones. Samuel Pepys describes in his diary a scene of pressed sailors' wives gathered on a wharf near the Tower of London. In my life, I never did see such a natural expression of passion as I did here in some women's bewailing themselves and running to every parcel of men that were brought, one after another, to look for their husbands, and wept over every vessel that went off, thinking that they might be there, and looking after the ship as far as ever they could by moonlight, that it grieved me to the heart to hear them. Those were the opening pages of a book called The Wager by David Graham. To add some context for the time period here, this story starts in Great Britain, of course, as I mentioned earlier, on essentially an armed merchant ship named The Wager, which is part of a fleet of ships that are attempting to do some damage to the Spanish Armada. This was in the midst of a war called the War of Jenkins' Ear. And I'm reading a song recounted in the book that goes, "They cut off his ears and slit his nose. Then with a jeer they gave him his ear, saying, take it to your master in disdain. But our king, I can tell, loves his subjects so well that he'll curb the haughty pride of Spain." And that sets the stage for what's going on here. Like I mentioned, the Wager was an East Indiaman, which was a general name for any merchant ship operating under charter or license to any of the East India companies of the major European trading powers of the 17th through the 19th century. This term is used to refer to vessels belonging to the Austrian, Danish, Dutch, British, French, Portuguese, or Swedish East India companies. The East India Company is an interesting one. I'm going to have to do a podcast just about them. They're still around, and they've been around for a long time. The Wager had a fairly rich history before Captain Cheap got a hold of it on this particular voyage. These vessels carried both passengers and goods and were armed to defend themselves against pirates. Initially, they were built to carry as much cargo as possible rather than for speed of sailing. They generally measured between 1,100 and 1,400 tons. They measured about 175 feet overall length of the hull, 144 feet keel, 43 feet beam, and 17 feet draft. I couldn't tell you what any of those mean. I think 17 feet draft is how much water they need to float in. If that gives you any idea of these ships. They're fairly large wooden boats, ships. I think boat's a different thing. Sails, and this one was armed, of course, because it was being used as a vessel of war instead of transport. This voyage for Cheap and the rest of the Armada really seemed to be plagued with the worst luck from the onset. I just described the issues they had getting manpower to staff the boat, overstaff the boat, and they set sail. They ran into a Spanish galleon. They chased it. It disappeared. And back to the book at this point, not long after, there came an invisible siege. Though no guns were fired, many of Bulkley's companions began to collapse as though struck by some malignant force. Boys could no longer muster the energy to climb the masts. The pressed invalids suffered the most, writhing in their hammocks, feverish and sweating, vomiting into pails or on themselves. Some were delirious and had to be watched so that they didn't stumble into the sea. The bacterial bomb of typhus, planted in the ships before they set sail, was now erupting throughout the fleet. Our men grew distempered and sickly, an officer observed, adding that the fever was beginning to reign among us. At least when the squadron was in England, the infected could be brought ashore to be treated. Now they were trapped on the overcrowded ships. Social distancing, had they even understood the concept, was impossible, and their lice-speckled bodies pressed against unsuspecting new victims. The lice would crawl from one seaman to another, and though their bites weren't dangerous, the traces of feces they deposited in the resulting wound were laden with bacteria. When a seaman innocently scratched the bite, the louse's saliva made it itch. He became an unwitting participant in his own bodily invasion. The pathogens entered his bloodstream like a stealth boarding party, then spread the contagion from louse to louse and into the lifeblood of the squadron. That is making me itch. The sailors at that time and popular medical practice really didn't have an understanding of parasite transmitted diseases, and so they, as men typically do, tend to aspire the onset of a mass influenced by a particular thing to bad spirits or bad tempers, chemicals in the body that they didn't understand that were out of balance, or maybe it was the gods that were, I think they were a little bit farther along than ascribing these things to the gods, but they're not far beyond that. But medicine, this is way before we really started understanding the process of sterilization. As that paragraph mentioned earlier, even if they understood social distancing, it was impossible. There were 250 men crammed onto a boat that was, or a ship that was only supposed to have 100 on it. They slept in hammocks, the crewmen did, in below decks, just above the very bottom of the ship, where if you can picture a container that's floating on the ocean, constantly being assaulted by corrosion, getting beat up by the waves, water washing over the deck, rain falling down, all the sweat, the liquids from the decks, from the animals that they brought with them. They brought livestock. The casks full of supplies, sweating, leaking, all that stuff makes its way to the very bottom of the ship. And these men are just one or two decks above that disgusting stew. So as they rest at night, they're piled up on top of each other. I believe in the space where you could lay one man down, they stacked up to three hammocks directly above him and packed them all in there. Then when they got up or their shift started, they would have to take their hammocks down so that the next sailor would come and hang his. So they're almost doing what we call today hot bunking. They were hot hammocking. But I just can only imagine the stench of that sleeping area right there and how horrible that must have been to suffer. Some men volunteered for this journey. Others were, as you heard, essentially kidnapped and forced. They were paid. Once they became part of the ship's crew, they did fall under an agreement that they were merchantmen of Her Majesty's Navy. So they were not slaves, but they didn't make a whole lot of money. I think they made £100. £100 at that time was the bottom end of actually having a decent job. As members of Anson's squadron became sick, the officers and surgeons roamed the deck, sniffing out potential culprits. Foul bilge, moldy sails, rancid meat, human sweat, rotten timber, dead rats, piss and excrement, unwashed livestock, dirty breath. The fetidness had unleashed a plague of bugs, one so biblical that it was unsafe, as Malchamp noted, for a man to open his mouth for fear of having them fly down his throat. Some crew members carved wooden boards into makeshift fans. There were a certain number of men who employed to wave backwards and forwards in order to agitate the infected air. Captain Murray and the other senior officers held an emergency conference with Anson. Bulkley was not included. There were certain rooms where he wasn't allowed. Bulkley becomes a pivotal character in this story, which we'll see later. And as we see so early on, he's already caused himself some issues with the crew. He soon learned that the officers had debated how to let in more air below decks. Anson ordered the carpenters to cut 6 additional openings in the hull of each man of war just above the waterline. Still, the plague accelerated with scores more infected. Ettrick and other doctors stationed in the sick bays grew overwhelmed. Tobias Smollett, whose picaresque novel The Adventures of Roderick Random drew on his experiences as a naval surgeon's mate during the war against Spain, wrote of an epidemic. I was much less surprised that people should die on board than that any sick person should recover. Here I saw about 50 miserable, distempered wretches suspended in rows, so huddled upon another and deprived of the light of day as well as the fresh air, breathing nothing but their own excrements and diseased bodies. As a sick patient fought for his life on the lonely seas far from home, his mates might visit him, holding a lantern over his vacant eyes and trying to cheer him up. Or perhaps, as a chaplain on a man of war describes it, dropping silent tears on him, or in the most heartrending accents calling him. One day on the Wager, several men emerged from the sick bay carrying a long, shrouded package. It was the dead body of one of their companions. According to tradition, a body to be buried at sea was wrapped in a hammock, along with at least one cannonball. When the hammock was sewn together, the final thread was often stitched through the victim's nose to ensure that he was dead. The stiffening corpse was placed on a plank, and a Union Jack was draped over it, making it seem less like a mummy. Any of the deceased's personal effects, his clothes, his trinkets, his sea chest, were collected for auction to raise money for his widow or other family members. Even the most hardened seamen often offered exorbitant bids. Death is at all times solemn, but never so much so at sea, one sailor recalled. The man is near you, at your side. You hear his voice, and in an instant he is gone, and nothing but a vacancy shows his loss. There is always an empty berth in the forecastle, and one man wanting when the small night watch is mustered. There is one less to take the wheel, and one less to lay out with you upon the yard. You miss his form and the sound of his voice, for habit has made them almost necessary to you, and each of your senses feels the loss. The Wager's bell tolled, and Bulkley, Byron, and the other men gathered on the deck and on the gangways and booms. The officers and crews of the other ships drew up nearby as well, forming a kind of funeral procession. The boatswain cried, "Off hats!" And the mourners bared their heads. They prayed for the dead, and perhaps for themselves too. Captain Murray recited the words, "We therefore commit his body to the deep." After the flag was removed, the plank was lifted up, and the body slid over the railing. A splash broke the silence. Bulkley and his mates watched their companion sinking under the weight of the cannonball until he vanished on that last unknown voyage into the depths of the ocean. We're on page 53. It hasn't even really started yet. I'll say this now, and I may wind up saying this a few times throughout this podcast, that the amount of suffering that these men endure over the course of this story is amazing. And the fact that at every turn it only gets worse is even more amazing. As we continue, the Armada is sailing its way towards the Cape of Good Hope. They're not there yet. Storms continue to batter the ships day and night. John Byron stared in awe at the waves that broke over the Wager, bandying the 123-foot vessel about as if it were no more than a pitiful rowboat. Water seeped through virtually every seam of the hull, floating the lower decks and causing the officers and crewmen to abandon their hammocks and berths. There was no longer any realm under the weather. The men's fingers would burn from gripping the wet ropes and the wet yards and the wet shrouds and the wet steering wheel and the wet ladders and the wet sails. Byron, drenched by the pouring rains as well as the waves, was unable to keep a dry thread on his body. Everything seemed to drip, to shrivel, to decompose. During that march of 1741, as the squadron plowed through the howling darkness toward the elusive Cape Horn, where were they exactly on the map? Byron endeavored to maintain a station on watch. He spread his feet like a bow-legged gaucho and held on to anything secure, otherwise he would be hurled into the frothing sea. Lightning blitzed the sky, flashing before him and then turning the world even blacker. The temperature kept dropping until the rains hardened into sleet and snow. Cables became encrusted with ice, and some of the men succumbed to frostbite. Below 40 degree latitude, there is no law, a sailor's adage went. Below 50 degrees, there is no God. And Byron and the rest of the crew were now in the furious 50s. The wind in these parts, he noted, blows with such violence that nothing can withstand it, and the sea runs so high that it works and tears a ship to pieces. It was, he concluded, the most disagreeable sailing in the world. He knew that the squadron needed every man aboard to persevere, but almost immediately after the Wager passed through the Strait of Lamar on March 7th, he noticed that many of his companions could no longer rise from their hammocks. Their skin began to turn blue, and then as black as charcoal, a luxuriance, as Reverend Walter put it, of fungus flesh. Their ankles swelled hideously, and whatever was consuming them progressed up their bodies into their thighs and their hips and their shoulders like some corrosive poison. When Schoolmaster Thomas suffered from the affliction, he recalled, he initially felt just a small pain in his left big toe, but soon noticed hard nodes and ulcerous sores spreading across his body. This was accompanied, he wrote, with such excessive pains in the joints of the knees, ankles, and toes as I thought before I experienced them that human nature could never have supported. Byron later caught the dreadful disorder and found that it engendered the most violent pain imaginable. As the scourge invaded the sailors' faces, some of them began to resemble the monsters of their imaginations. Their bloodshot eyes bulged. Their teeth fell out, as did their hair. Their breath reeked of what one of Byron's companions called an unwholesome stench, as if death had already come upon them. The cartilage that glued together their bodies seemed to be loosening. In certain cases, even old injuries reemerged. A man who had been injured at the Battle of the Boyne, which took place in Ireland more than 50 years earlier, had his ancient wounds suddenly break out anew. Still more astonishing, Reverend Walter observed, one of this man's bones that had healed after fracturing at the Boyne now dissolved again as if it had never been consolidated. Then there were the effects on the senses. One moment the men might be overcome with visions of bucolic streams and pastures. Then, realizing where they would sink into complete despair. Reverend Walter noted that this strange dejection of the spirits was marked by shiverings, tremblings, and the most dreadful terrors. One medical expert compared it to the falling down of the whole soul. Byron saw some of the men descend into lunacy, or, as one of his companions wrote, The disease got into their brains and they ran raving mad. They were suffering from what a British captain had dubbed the plague of the sea, scurvy. Like everyone else, Byron didn't know what caused it. Striking a company after at least a month at sea, it was the great enigma of the age of sail, killing more mariners than all other threats, including gun battles, tempests, wrecks, and other diseases combined. On Anson's ships, scurvy appeared after the men were already ailing, leading to one of the most severe maritime outbreaks. I cannot pretend to describe that terrible distemper, the ordinary phlegmatic Anson reported, but no plague ever equaled the degree we had of it. One night, during the endless storm, as Byron struggled to sleep in his soaked, rattling berth, he heard the eight bells and strove to get on deck for another watch. As he staggered through the labyrinth of the ship, it was difficult to see. Lamps had been extinguished for fear that they might topple and catch fire. Even the cook was not permitted to light his stove, forcing the men to eat their meat raw. When Byron emerged on the quarterdeck, feeling the cold blast of wind, he was startled to find only a few dozen people on watch. The greatest part of the men, Byron wrote in his account, had been disabled through fatigue and sickness. The ships were in danger of running out of hands to operate them. The surgeon, Henry Ettrick, who, after the Centurion's chief surgeon died, was relocated there from the Wager, tried to staunch the outbreak. Down on the Centurion's orlop deck, cloaked in a smock, he took out his saw and cut open several corpses, trying to pinpoint the cause of the disease. Perhaps the dead would save the living. According to reports of his findings, the victims, bones after the flesh was scraped off, appeared quite black, and their blood seemed to have a peculiar color, like that of a black and yellow liquor. After several dissections, Ettrick proclaimed that the disease was introduced by the frigid climate. Yet, when it was pointed out to Ettrick that scurvy was just as prevalent in tropical climates, he conceded that the cause might remain an entire secret. The outbreak raged on, a storm within the storm. After Ettrick had moved to the Centurion, the Charles surgeon, Walter Elliott, had been relocated to the Wager. Byron described him as a generous, active, and very strong young man who seemed destined to survive the longest. Elliott was devoted to Captain Cheap, who was now battling scurvy himself. It was a very great misfortune, Elliott remarked, that their captain should be ill at such a time. The doctor did everything in his power to help Cheap and Byron and the other ailing men, but what remedies existed were as worthless as the theories behind them. A number of people believing that there must be something in the nature of land vital to humans claimed that the only cure was burying the sick up to their chins in soil. An officer on another voyage recalled the bizarre sight of 20 men's heads stuck out of the ground. While Anson's expedition was trapped at sea, the main medicine prescribed was Dr. Joshua Ward's Pill and Drop, a purgative that was advised as performing many marvelous and sudden cures. Anson, who refused to let his men undergo what he would not endure himself, took the pills first. Thomas wrote that most of the men who consumed them were seized very violently, both by vomit and stool. One sailor, after a single pill, began to pour blood from his nostrils and lay near the point of death. Ward turned out to be a quack. His potion contained poisonous amounts of the metalloid antimony and some suspected arsenic. The pills purged the sick of needed nutrients, likely contributing to many deaths. The surgeon Ettrick, who would later die of illness on the voyage, conceded despairingly that all of his available treatments were useless. Yet the solution was so simple. Scurvy is brought on by a deficiency of vitamin C, owing to a lack of raw vegetables and fruits in one's diet. Such a deprived person stops producing the fibrous protein known as collagen, which holds bones and tissues together and which is used to synthesize dopamine and other hormones that can affect moods. Anson's men also appear to have been suffering from other vitamin deficiencies, such as insufficient levels of niacin, which can lead to psychosis, and of vitamin A, which causes night blindness. Lieutenant Somerez later sensed the power of certain nutrients. I could plainly observe, he wrote, that there is a yea nay say qua in the frame of the human system that cannot be renewed, cannot be preserved without the assistance of certain earthly particles, or in plain English, the land is a man's proper element and vegetables and fruit his only physic. All Byron and his companions needed to combat scurvy was some citric, and when they stopped at St. Catherine to gather supply, there had been an abundance of limes. The cure, that unforbidden fruit which decades later would be furnished to all British seamen, giving them the nickname Limeys, had been right within their grasp. So the Wager was continued to be assaulted by this storm, by multiple storms, by high seas. They were in a part of the ocean that was known to be extremely volatile and difficult to navigate. And they used this concept called dead reckoning. I'm probably going to mess this up. It's easy to determine what latitude you're on. I think you can use the stars for that. It's hard to determine what longitude you're on, which made it real difficult for them to predict exactly when to turn right or left or what's around the next bend. So navigating in fog at that time, at night at that time, was probably about a good bit of luck and a good bit of skill, and maybe done with some prayers. I'm not sure. It's terrifying to look back and think about that. And all this is happening in the midst of typhus, scurvy. People are weak and sick and dying, and their muscles are peeling themselves away from their bones. But this armada continues on its mission into the storm, into the unknown. Everybody's sick. The ships are undermanned. They kept going. They didn't turn around. They didn't even start talking about turning around. The thought never occurred to them. They wind up crashing their ship onto the rocks, and they find themselves shipwrecked on Patagonia. Remember when I said that just when things seem like they're pretty bad, they just keep getting worse? Seems like there's not a lot, at least in the part of Patagonia that they were on, and it seems like that they didn't explore more than a couple miles away from the beach. I don't understand why, but they find themselves stranded on an island. They lost the rest of the fleet in the storm. And from what the book describes, there's nobody there. Nobody lives on Patagonia, or nobody lived in that part of Patagonia at that time. There was not a lot of wildlife or birds, not a lot of fish. They would occasionally run across the seal. They would shoot the seal and eat it. But they salvaged as much of the supplies as they could from the boat, from the ship, and survived on that for as long as they could. And it just gets worse. It keeps getting worse. The people still have no supplies, no communication with the outside world. They're stranded somewhere that they don't understand. They don't know how to live there. The crew starts to fracture. Of course, I guess that makes sense given human nature. And people would set up camps in different areas, and they went to war with each other, sort of respectfully in a way. There was a lot of division. A mutiny or two occurs. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Some of them survive that shipwreck and being stranded on that island. But it still keeps getting worse. It's an interesting book if you can make it past the first few chapters and get through all the disgustingness of what it was like to live on a ship like that back then. It's an interesting story, and I haven't even touched it. I think I might have got to page 80 or 90, and there's still a couple hundred pages left in the book. So if you've ever had aspirations of being a seaman, be hopefully grateful that you didn't live in the 1700s. I've been on a battleship once, and it's the room available is pretty sparse. The ship is built to serve the ship's needs, and every extra square foot of space that you put on that thing for people to be comfortable in is really just a waste of space and fuel and efficiency and speed and all that other stuff. I won't pretend like I know too much about ships beyond that. But there you go. The Wager, David Graham. There's a lot more there. Hope y'all are doing well. Catch you next time.